The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the 11th episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this one is definitely for people looking to buy gifts over the holidays. I'm going to be joined in a little bit by Carrie Mortimer, and she's an LCBO consultant. And that's actually where I met her, at the one of the giant LCBOs down by the lake on the Queen's Quay, and she always did a great job of helping me find wine and giving suggestions. It's kind of exactly what you want from your product consultant. And then just we became friends, running some of the same circles, and she agreed to do the podcast. And she's got some pretty wild stories about customers, some crazy ones, things on guys' phones, which really, I got to tell you, really shouldn't be on anyone's phone. So we're going to talk to her about wines you guys can get for the holidays, from inexpensive ones to, if you're going to buy that really nice $100-plus bottle, what you should get. She has a lot of fantastic suggestions. And let's face it, Christmas is coming. I was out shopping all day today, and it's pretty nuts. One quick tip. If you're going to do all your shopping, go alone. And if you have kids, if your partner can take care of the kids for the while, it'll mean everything. You get to weave around. It's easier to get in and out. Lineups aren't as bad if you just, you're on your own banging out a podcast or something. So just a little tip. I was at the Eaton Center yesterday and managed to get away with it. But what I wanted to do was go over some books. I want to give you guys some book suggestions, either ones for you or it could be books for people in your family, the wine lovers, the wine fanatics, whatever in your life, friends, family, boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever. I was at Chapters today and woof, that place was packed. So just wanted to give some thoughts and suggestions. The first one is Wine Folly, and this is by Madeleine Paquette and Justin Hammack, and I probably mispronounced their names. And they do a whole bunch of different books. They got a website, Twitter account, but it's called Wine Folly, The Essential Guide to Wine. And what's great about this one is just all the pictures. And I don't mean that in a, oh, are you a dum-dum about wine and you need pictures? No. This is like charts, graphs. It does a really good job of really pushing home every different grape and, say Zinfandel, and they've got a wheel of flavors from dill, hickory, sweet tobacco to raspberry, strawberry, and they do it, and it's actually done in a wheel with different colors, and there's maps everywhere, and it's a really good, concise book, just if you need help. Like, if you are looking at what the hell's Petit Verdot, it will tell you everything about the fruit body, tannin, acidity, and alcohol. And by the way, you're probably not drinking 100% Petit Verdot. It's a blending grape often found in Bordeaux. I just randomly picked that page. But this is, it's good. It's a really simple, easy book. I bought it a couple of years ago. It probably runs around $30 or so. Madeleine, certified sommelier with a quartermaster sommelier. Justin is a founding partner of Wine Folly. Great book. You can find it in soft cover. They got a website, winefolly.com. So that is a really good book, just in terms of, I want to learn about wine. What the hell am I drinking? What should I be tasting? And I don't want tons of flowery prose. I just want to get to the heart of it. Next up, let's get a little more hardcore for a second here. Oh, this is a big one. It's an Atlas. I think they're on the 8th edition. I have the 7th. This is the World Atlas of Wine, and it is done by the rock stars of the wine world, Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. And I find, for anyone, this is a book for people that want to learn more about what they're drinking. If you're just the kind of person that just wants to know a little bit and you just want to, you just drink wine for the joy of it because you like the taste and the different smells and all that, fantastic. Life's short, so find what you love. But if you're the sort of person that wants to learn a little bit more, this book's great because they lay it all out, every wine region in the world, from, you know, Burgundy and Bordeaux to Romania. And what I love about it is, you know, they go through it all. So each area, what's the major soil or temperature? What's the most famous grapes? What is this area known for? And I got to tell you, this book, every day when I was studying, I would go through this book. They do a great job of showing you where, say, in Europe, where's the Grand Cru vineyards? Where's the Premier Cru ones? Even like I'm right now, I'm just looking through, you know, one of the famous rivers in Moselle, and I can see my old notes here. I'm circling all the famous German vineyards, most of them, you know, Burgkastel, most of them I can't even properly pronounce. It's a fantastic book. I think when I do wine events, and by the way, if anyone wants to hire me, MCause56, for people that really wanted to know about wine, when I would do events for, you know, for a party, it was usually smaller ones, I would bring a map. And people always appreciate it because they could, it really contextualize what you're drinking. You know, if you're drinking a wine from Loire, it's like, okay, well, let's really nail this. Let's nail exactly, you know, why this is a Sauvignon versus, you know, this is more of a sweet one, a Côte du Lion. Wow, I mispronounced that one. Anyway, onwards and upwards. Atlases are great. They are essential for study. Anyone taking any level of wine test, whether it's WSET, Quartermaster, Sommelier, CAPS, I don't care who it is, maps are critical for knowing about wine. And it's Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. They're the best. And the amount of work they put into this book, it's crazy. And they update it year to year. Now, you know, if you have to get an older one, like the 7th or 6th, you're fine. It's not like those scams in university where you have to buy the new textbook every year. All right, let's go to a fun one. The Billionaire's Vinegar. I used this book a couple of years ago for a book club that I'm still in. In fact, I had an event over the weekend. And this is a great book. Most of it's about a gentleman who passed away this past May at the age of 76, Hardy Rodenstock, who was a... Some will say a wine counterfeiter. Others say he was a preeminent guy in terms of bringing in old wines. And he got sued, and so much of the wine community eventually called him out on it. Because he had these crazy old bottles from Thomas Jefferson. And by crazy old bottles, I'm talking Chateau Lafite from 1787, Chateau de Chem from 1784, a half bottle of a 1784 Chateau Margaux. And what this book is about, and I love what Business Week, they describe it as part detective story, part wine history. Because is Hardy Rodenstock guilty? He gets sued by the Koch brothers, you know, the billionaires in America. And you learn a lot about wine. You learn a lot about wine history. Man, there are some great slices about wine culture and just how nuts it is. And this book tells the story of the world's most expensive bottle of wine, and Hardy Rodenstock, who brought it in. And these wines are being sold at auctions for, you know, 156,000 American. And, you know, that was like 15, 20 years ago when that wine was purchased. Great book. So good. The film rights purchased by some people in Hollywood, by HBO. At one point, Brad Pitt was attached to play one of the parts. Now it looks like it might be Matthew McConaughey. It's a really fun book. The Billionaire's Vinegar. Even if you don't like wine, it's a great one. I'll do two real quick. Oz Clark, Grapes and Wines. This one, remember I was talking about wine earlier, the Wine Folly. Think of this as the next level up in terms of education. He goes over every grape, goes into great detail, and like just I'll go to just one of the chapters, Chenin Blanc. So, you know, how it works for all the major grapes, you get the geography and the history of it, you get how the grape is grown in the vineyard, and just what are the vinification techniques that work best, in the vineyard, profiles where Chenin Blancs found all around the world, Loire, South Africa, even California, Australia, and then just what these wines should taste like. And finally, you know, famous producers from all over the world. And it's great. Like another book I used a ton. This is a really good one. So Wine Folly, I would say for the person that's into wine, who wants to learn a little bit more, Grapes and Wines by Oz Clark. Yeah, the books are heavy. That's one for someone that is a little bit more hardcore. There may be someone that not necessarily going to take courses, but they're the sort of person that wants to write down the wines they try at restaurants and the ones that like to talk to servers, somms, whoever, to learn more about what they're drinking. The Oz Clark and also Margaret Rand. Margaret Rand is also a big part of it as well. Excuse me. Grapes and Wine. And finally, the granddaddy of them all. And she's back for a second time, Jancis Robinson, and gets help from Julia Harding, who's also a big name in the wine education field. The Oxford Companion to Wine. Damn. This book here, I built muscles and hurt my back with this book. This is your classic encyclopedia on everything. I mean, you know, from it'll have sections on wine in movies or TV show, and then it'll talk about drought-resistant rootstock. It's a real page-turner. Okay, for this one, only for either hardcore wine person, preferably someone who's retired, or someone that is going to be studying and taking, they're going to be pursuing a long time, and they're going to really be pursuing their wine education. So, there it is, 5 different books for you to check out. You can find one on Amazon, Chapters, most bookstores, and go into the bookstore. Yeah, I know the lineup's so long, but, you know, our empathy starts getting killed if we do everything online and we're just at home all the time. You know, sometimes you got to get out there and press the flesh. And, yeah, some of those lineups, there's a lot of flesh pressing. Ooh, I mispronounced that. Flesh. Ooh, I can't even do that. Man, maybe I'll edit this out. Probably won't. Flesh pressing. All right, that's enough of me. I've been yammering on way too long. Thank you very much for everyone who's been listening to the pod. As I said, you can get us iTunes, on Stitcher, on Audio Boom. So without further ado, a really smart person. And if you ever run into her in the LCBO, consider yourself lucky because she can help you out with wine. Here is Carrie Mortimer. Joining me, because I think she's laughing at the name, Carrie Mortimer, consultant at the LCBO. Carrie, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
So before we start, just a little bit of bio in terms of where you are in the wine world, in terms of specific title and degrees or courses or all that kind of stuff.
So I tend to call myself a corporate sellout because I left the option of working nights at a restaurant until 2 in the morning to work 8:30 to 5:30. You know, max maybe 9:30 at night to have a steady paycheck and vacation and sick days, because that's not normal in the hospitality world. It's a pretty great thing.
Yeah.
When you can actually have paid vacation and sick days. I started at Niagara College and took a wine marketing course, and it went downhill from there. And I just, you know, fell into the world of wine and haven't resurfaced since. So it's been fun. So my title is a product consultant, which means we run a vintages section. So I manage inventory with the help of a coworker now that's a product consultant, which is great. It's a lot of fun. So we get to kind of pick and choose what we want from what the LCBO has in stock.
Yeah. Actually, and I got to know Carrie a little bit from you just helping me at the LCBO, the one down on Cooper Street. And also the mutual friends like Emily Pierce and a bunch of other people as well. Okay, I'm going to go in a completely different direction.
Okay.
Do you, just because by your first answer, do you feel like a sellout?
No.
Good.
I mean,
because quality of life is important.
It's a better way of living. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm super jealous of my girls that get to go on paid vacations to wine countries and areas. But I mean, you can't go wrong getting that time to go and do something. I spent my entire vacation, which was paid. We get 15 days a year. So I went for 3 weeks to Italy and didn't have to worry about not having a paycheck when I came home, which is the best idea in the world because it makes you have a lot more fun when you're not worrying about your trip costs.
Peace of mind is important. Like, there is the romanticism about working in the little restaurant and it's your own list. And then people will sometimes scorn the corporate lifestyle, but there's also quality of life and being happy. Did you feel any scorn is too strong? I'm trying to think of hyperbole like that, but did some people turn their noses to what you were doing?
I mean, it's the category of the company I work for, I suppose, is the best way to phrase it. It's very hit and miss if you either love us or you hate us.
And sometimes both. Sometimes I love the LCBO and sometimes I hate the LCBO. And it's not even necessarily the actual bricks and mortar and the employees. It's more the provincial government than it is the actual stores.
I mean, the best way to relate it, if you want to put it into sports terms, we're basically the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah.
You love us half the time and you hate us because we never win.
Yeah.
It's the best sports analogy I can come up with because it's very hit and miss. I mean, we can turn haters into lovers. We're starting to bring in some really interesting product, which is great. So we're turning a little bit of the eyes around a little bit when you're in that SOM community and you want the weird things. So it's good. It's a gradual process to make people come around.
Okay. Eventually I'll get to my question. Also, by the way, I should let you know that the reason that Carrie was brought on is we're going to go over wines that you guys can buy for the holidays, whether you're going to a party, whether you're hosting a party, just, you know, we'll go white, rosé, red, maybe even some port, whatever. We'll go through it all. But now I'm fascinated because the one word you used is weird. And in the hardcore wine world, we love weird. We love trying the Spätburgunder. We love trying, you know, wines. And by the way, in the hardcore wine world, that's not even a weird wine.
No, it's a great wine.
It's great wine. But for you, how much do you have to, like, how much difficulty is that push and pull between, I need to bring in all the wines that I know are going to make us money, that are going to sell, because we're still a business, versus I want to still have my rep. I want my wine cred. Thus, I need to get in this funky Gruner that you don't normally get.
I mean, it's difficult. So in the world of weird, I love high acid whites. Give me Riesling every day of the week and I'll be happy.
Yes.
It's the love of my life. Yeah. I have fought to get Riesling producers into the market, and finally Bernard from Le Sommelier has brought my favorite Riesling producer from Germany in, so I'm super excited.
Can you pronounce? Because all my favorite German producers, I know what it looks like, but I often can't pronounce the name.
Honestly, super, super easy. It's Eva Frick. She's this incredible boss of a woman that's not afraid to tell anyone off. Mm-hmm. I watched her in New York at a conference, a seminar, and the wine writer kept cutting her off, and the questions were directed to her. She told him, shut up.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank you, because it's about time someone did that. And if you're asking her a question, she's going to be fearless. She's going to make the wines that she wants. It's a cabinet. It's going to be a cabinet. It's not going to be drinking like a Spätlese, which is what I want.
Yeah.
So Eva is, for me, my powerhouse. So you fight for the wines that you love. And I mean, I love Sicilian wines. So getting good Sicilian wines in store has been, you know, hit and miss. Sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't. Right now,
that must be tough.
It's hard. It's what the buyers are buying, and you have to dictate. So I pull a lot of stock from classics. So anything that doesn't sell out through our online ordering, those monthly little blurbs, we can bring into the storefront. So I bring in all of my weird stuff from there, which is great because I can get, you know, Etna Blanco, which sells surprisingly well in King West. When I first got there, the weirder stuff was taking a while to get there, as your, you know, your basic $20 Cali cabs and
so much Barolo-y. And you know, you can find that. And also one I would recommend, I'd imagine you know this better than I, if you're more New World, well, get the Planinta.
Yeah.
Because those are big oak, powerful
ones. I had three different single varietal Norellos, which was awesome. And they sold like crazy because they do drink Pinot-esque, and it's kind of awesome to watch people come back and be like, that was actually delicious. And I mean, I'm weird in the way I approach people, and maybe it's not the best way, but I'll tend to actually ask them if they're buying a gift for someone, are they someone that cares about labels or are they unique? Because if they're someone that's kind of, you know, a label freak, let's put it in that term.
Get them the cake.
Yeah, get them something that's more
traditional
is the right word. And if they're willing to take the risk and they're unique, or maybe they're vintage, then you can get them something a little bit more creative.
Yeah.
Which is the right way to play it, because you'll find people kind of light up when you put it into that term, especially the millennial generation. Because if I just ask you, you know, do they want classic wines, traditional wines, or are they willing to take a risk? They don't really understand the concept. But if I put it as, are they more basic or are they unique? they'll be like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, everyone's going to answer unique. No one's going, well, I'm pretty basic and I'm just, I like to follow the labels.
Oh, no. I've had some people being like, oh, no, all she cares about is labels. So yeah. I'm like, oh.
But they won't admit that about themselves.
Some of them do. Really? Some of them are willing to, which is awesome. At least, you know, they're.
That's great to be that honest.
It's King West. You can be as honest as you want to be and yeah. No one's really going to judge you because it's King West.
What does it look like? Because you said I sometimes have to fight for these wines. What is that process to get, you know, single varietal stuff from Etna, you know, onto the shelves?
I mean, for me, it's if it's in the warehouse, because I'm not a flagship store, I also don't really want to be, you can't control flagship exclusives. It means that I might not be first in line to get the product. So it's either I'm going to have to ask a fellow PC at a different store to let me take some of their stock just to have on my shelf, or I'll have to wait a month or two at a time just to get, you know, some interesting product.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about crazy stories of customers. Also, just what is the busiest days for you guys look like? Because the LCBO, when you get close to Christmas Eve, that place is a madhouse. It's like a alcoholic version of Lord of the Flies. But I want to start just giving people some recommendations. Like, first off, you were very nice. You opened up some Spanish sparkling rosé. What are we drinking?
We're just drinking a Cordonnier. It went on clearance, so I stockpiled it. It's the best sour cherry rhubarb strawberry sparkling wine you can get for the value.
Rhubarb especially.
So rhubarb.
So much, yeah.
There's so much concentration, and I'm sad to see that this goes, because this is actually one of my favorite sparklers, because it's just so easy to drink.
Do you ever tell people when they're going to buy a bottle? No, just leave that here. You don't want that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've completely tried to hide stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it happens. I mean, I love bubbly. I think it's the best way to go. I have some great English sparkling wine on the shelf right now. I've ordered a ton of Franciacorta because, I mean, who doesn't want Franciacorta?
And for people who don't know, Franciacorta is Northern Italy's version of champagne. And, in fact, I think they have their average minimum aging time is actually longer than champagne.
It is longer, yeah. Most actually average 36 months for their non-vintage Franciacorta, and that's what you do for vintage champagne.
Yeah.
So it's awesome, and it's, you know, $45 to $55. So you're still looking at champagne prices, but you're getting a little bit more quality.
And you still, $55, that's still cheaper than most of the champagne. It's certainly cheaper than Veuve.
Which is true.
So, okay. So this one, again, tell the people which one this is.
So this is a Cordonnier Reventos, but if you didn't get it before, it's gone. I'm sorry. I bought the bulk of it.
So what would you recommend for people out there? You know, if we start with a sparkling, what would you recommend?
Right now we just released Nino Franco's Prosecco. I love Nino Franco. He's probably one of the best people. Primo Franco is now running the company, and he was the most energetic person I've ever met in my life. It's sad to see his family name go, because he only had daughters and they only had daughters following. So,
yeah.
But it's a great, easy drinking Prosecco. So it's a little bit more stone fruit. There's a little bit more peach and a little bit more pear to it, actually. So it's really nice and refreshing, and it's super dry.
And not as sweet as some of the Proseccos that are out there that you don't often get that.
He's a brute, so you're looking around like 11 grams of sugar per liter, so it's still good. If you want your chocolate quota of the day, you know, you can still drink Nino Franco and not feel too guilty, where if you go into a more Prosecco-based, you might not be able to get that.
Yeah.
For me, around Christmas time, I love bringing in some nice whites. Sparkling's always classic, but you know, Rieslings pair with everything.
Yes.
It's the easiest wine to bring to a dinner if you
Carrie,
bring a dry wine.
Preach about the Riesling.
It's all about the Riesling. Rieslings and Syrahs and Gamay. Mm-hmm. You know, there's three wines that can go with basically any food group, and Riesling is one of them. And I mean, I know people have this prejudice that Riesling is always sweet. It's not. Please get it out of your head. There's a lot of great dry Rieslings that are just so easy to go with anything, especially oysters.
Yeah,
good dry Riesling with oysters is perfect. So even like, you know, just getting an Austrian Riesling would go perfect. They're a little meaner, I would say, when it comes to dryness.
Now, explain that, because I was about to go into the difference between Austria and Germany. And you're absolutely right. Like a Cabernet Moselle versus an Austrian Riesling. The Austrian Riesling, that's a good way of putting it. It is meaner. What does that mean?
I think the best way of saying it's meaner is Austrian Riesling is bone dry. There's no give with sugar, and the acidity is super high. So you're getting this tight, lean wine, and it's just a little, it makes your mouth pucker more than a Moselle Cabernet. I mean, Moselle Cabernet has a little bit of sugar, more so than not. I mean, really, if you want to compare, your best way is going like a Rheinhessen or a Rheingau specifically Cabernet to Austrian, because they're going to be drier than your Moselles, which is awesome. And there's smaller producers in the Rheingau, so especially there's a ton of these small younger generation coming out making these killer Cabernet style. But yeah, Austrian's mean. It's rough around the edges. It takes you a little bit while to go to it. It's super linear. They almost need a little time to open before you can get any flavor off them.
Would you decant it?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had Rieslings from, Germany and Austria that needed a day before they gave you any fruit.
Really?
Yeah. My friend and I did a test and it was 30 hours the one day for one wine to open up, which is insane.
Yeah.
That's a risk.
Yeah, that is a risk.
But it was totally worth it in the end.
And for people to just Cabernet, like the two most common types in Germany, Cabernet and Spätlese. And it just means like the amount, just the amount of sugar that's in it. And just, it's just this different styles like Cabernet, Spätlese, Oschlese. They're just different styles of Riesling.
Yeah. It's basically the sugar, grams of sugar per liter. So
yeah.
If you're worried about your diet, stick to Cabernet or Trocken. If you're not worried about the sugar,
yeah,
kick it up to a Spätlese or an Oschlese.
Yeah. Thank you for pronouncing it correctly.
No
one mangles names more than I do. One of my favorite moments with Oschlese was after a marathon.
No.
I was sitting in a bath. This was hours later with just a very hearty glass of Oschlese. And it was just perfect.
Yeah.
Because I needed to pamper myself after that.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, German words, seriously, really hard to pronounce half them. One of their vineyards, I mean, if you think about it, Schosshofberger.
Yeah.
Who knows how to pronounce that on a regular basis?
You do.
It took me so long to be able to pronounce that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. For reds, you mentioned Gamay and Syrah. Why? And you were sort of alluding to it just because they're very food friendly. But sing the praises. Why should people these holiday seasons be seeking out Syrah and Gamay?
I mean, these are pretty misunderstood grape varietals. You'll see that I kind of tend to go with the miscast a little bit. Riesling, Gamay, Syrah. Everyone has prejudice to them, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Syrah can tend to be a little too animalist. So people tend to not really think about it. I mean, it's pretty full-bodied, but it also pairs really nice. Syrah and lamb, excellent. Especially red meats. But you can also do like a nice duck with a Syrah. That meatiness comes out in the Syrah with the food matches. I've done it with lighter foods as well, and it still pairs. You could do it with charcuterie. It works well, and it just kind of takes away, and it's a little bit in the same, and the spice is just a little bit better. Especially Syrah over Syrahs, it's totally different, and it's more structured, let's say. It's drier. There's more spice. It's not as fruit forward. It's easier to drink. Gamay is just perfect because it's a light, easy drinking wine. You can get great concentration in some of the higher price point Gamays, and they can get a little bit more spice and a little bit more rough and more earthy. But you can just do so much more with these wines. Don't get me wrong, I love a good Brunello, and you can do a lot with Brunello and Barolo, but you can find quality without spending the price point in Syrah and Gamay. That being said, some Syrahs are ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, I mean, we go up to Cote Roti, the Lalas. I mean, so much of that. You're spending $300 on some of those a bottle. What are areas? Because you said Syrah over Shiraz, so we're going to put Australia to the side for a moment.
Pretty much.
Nothing wrong with your Barossa. But for your Syrahs, I'm assuming, obviously, the Rhone area.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, the Rhone is fantastic. It's the birthplace of Syrah, and you can't get much better quality-wise. And there is a few that are sitting on the shelf, and they're under $100, which is great, or they're in and around $100. So you're not spending too much. You're not going up to La La prices, which are a little bit too much for my budget, at least. But you're getting a bit better off. And I mean, I love a good Coronas. They're a little bit more earthy. They're more animal. You're also, for the most part, in Coronas, still getting that balanced alcohol level where a lot of red wines, especially in, you know, the Southern Rhone and Northern Rhone, for that matter, are getting up to 14% alcohol. They're still sitting at 13.5, 14.
But they see 13.5, you can assume some of them are 14.
Yeah, easily assume that it's 14. I mean, they have a point of percentage that they can get away with legally, label-wise. But the best wines are wines that are 13.5 for food pairings. A 14.5% alcohol wine could kill your meal.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going that much effort to make a good meal, why ruin it with bottle of wine that's got too much alcohol?
And that's a great point for people listening. Just when we talk about food pairing, and you always wonder about, oh, you might want to make sure it's the right body of wine with the right, you know, food and the spice and sweetness and all these things. But part of it is just alcohol level. I love Amarone. If I'm drinking Amarone, it is near the end of the evening, just because the alcohol levels can get high. And right, and it can overwhelm what you're cooking.
I mean, most Amarones these days are sitting at 9 grams of residual sugar per liter, and 15.5-16% alcohol is super common in Amarone now, just because of the process of making it. So you don't really want to put that with your, you know, let's say you went to a fancy butcher shop and got a tomahawk steak. You're gonna kind of kill that tomahawk.
Yeah. For Gamay, actually, I'll say this, because Gamay, obviously the classic area, you know, Beaujolais. And the great thing about that is you can get a good crew Beaujolais for mid to high 20s easily. Yeah.
I mean, most Gamays we're getting right now are $22.
Yeah.
How much better can you do that? You're getting a quality wine. Most of the time it's a smaller household, so you're not dealing with, you know, mass production, which is awesome. And you're getting a quality wine.
Yeah.
And there's so much you can do with Gamay. I mean, you could start with it. I tend to like doing, there's a soup that my family makes. It's a tomato gin soup. It has bacon in it and mushrooms. It's awesome. And gin. Putting a Gamay with that, super tasty. It kind of brings out some of that flavor.
I've never known gin in a soup before. This is, wait, what kind of soup is he going to say?
It's called tomato gin soup.
Tomato gin soup.
It's super hearty, but it's kind of just nice. It gives some flavors to it. There's a lot of thyme and tons of garlic, so it plays a little well.
Mm-hmm. And what about Ontario? Because I think Syrah, you know, Creekside Estate, which is in near St. Catharines, makes a good Syrah. I've had some good Gamay Noirs, 13th Street. I was wondering,
Malivore,
Malivore. Yeah.
Especially Courtney's. Honestly, this year, Big Head shocked me like crazy. Their Syrah was outstanding. I couldn't believe it was from Ontario, actually, and there's no oak aging to it.
Yeah.
It was done all in concrete tank. Awesome. I actually opened up August Clap beside it, and I was shocked at how well it stood up.
Really?
And
for people who don't know, August Clap is an iconic Syrah producer from Rhone.
One of the most iconic Coronas producers
exactly.
out there. I mean, there was no oak done on the Big Head Syrah, but there was a touch of Brett to it. So it kind of stood up really nice to the August Clap. It actually almost drank like there was oak to the Big Head in comparison to the August Clap. And I had it, you know, a week and a half after it was bottled, and it was so structurally sound. I can't wait to see how that wine will develop.
We'll continue on the CanCon portion of this interview. Just some Canadian recommendations out there. You know, Ontario, BC, anywhere you want. And obviously ones that you can find. Which are some of your favorites?
I love Hidden Bench. Love Hidden Bench. Harold makes great wines. Boring Owl is fantastic. When you can find them, 8th generation from BC is also super tasty.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, you know, I tend to like some of the Nova Scotian sparklings. So Benjamin Bridge, their higher tier, is super good. But also I love Hinterland. I mean, there's something to be said about what Vicky's doing out there that's incredible. And the Old Third.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously these are a little bit harder to get, but they're making some great wines. And if you want something like for camping that's in a can in the summertime, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the Between the Lines sparkling in a can. It's perfect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Without having to carry glass with you. So there's lots of options. I mean, we're doing a lot of great wines. We really excel in Riesling, Chardonnay, Cab Franc, especially, and Gamay.
Yeah.
And Pinot, of course.
Yeah.
We're doing great with the classic varieties.
Yeah, the Cab Franc from Pearl Morset is, yeah. I'm getting angry about how they're becoming more and more popular. I found them out about 4 years ago, and now, you know, everyone knows about
Pearl Morset. Knows. Yeah. I mean, even Cab Sauv down in Lake Erie, North Shore is crazy. I remember a few years ago, six, give or take, I was a volunteer student judge with the all Canadian wine competition, and we went to Muscadiri. And it was two high school teachers just starting out making wine in their parents' basement.
Really?
So we went down and we tried their Cab Sauv, and it was, you know, 14% alcohol from Ontario and fully ripe. But because it's so much warmer down in Lake Erie, North Shore,
yeah,
that they could get, you know, actually ripe, no green varietal characteristics on a Cab Sauv from Ontario. It was crazy. It was super delicious. I haven't tried it in, you know, 5 years, but...
Yeah. I mean, it must just depend also on the vintage, because,
yeah,
man, that's hard. Like 100% Cabernet, it's almost without that just green bell pepper smacking you around. It's hard. It's incredibly hard. You know what part of it is? Part of it is I don't think I want consistent 100% Cabernet Sauvignon from Ontario, because that means that climate change is really starting to have an impact.
It's really starting to have an impact. I mean, even if you think of the county, and there's some years that they're not getting quality fruit because it's just not ripening. They're not getting warmer, but you're seeing more consistent vintages from places like Prince Edward County.
Yeah.
And I mean, that means that climate change is kicking in. I'm starting to think that maybe my grandma should rip up some of the trees and plant some vines in Muskoka, and we'll see how it goes, because give it another 20 years, those vines will be nice and old, and maybe I can make some good wine in Muskoka, which would be awesome.
I love this idea. We should form a winery. I got a cottage up there as well.
It would be like a 5-minute boat ride down the lake to it.
And we just go from cottage to cottage. There's a lot of money up there.
There's a lot of money. I'm sure I could have a few people.
You know what we'll do? We'll label it as cake bread, but we'll put another E on the end, or on cake. We'll put two E's there so we can avoid the legality of it, because Muskoka, it's a lot of Americans with money.
It's true.
They like their Camus and the cake bread. Nothing against it. I mean, you know, just it can be an easy sell.
I mean, I started laughing. One of the kids I used to babysit is doing some, I think it's production work or writing work for one of the TV shows, Working Moms, actually.
Yeah.
So he made a fake wine label to put on one of the bottles, and it was Mortimer's Point Red.
Oh!
And I died laughing, because he did it as an homage, because his cottage is up there. So died laughing. I was like, that could be worth it, you know, to just toss out a red blend and see if we could make some... I mean, it would have to be a hearty variety. Maybe Baco could survive up
Maybe
there right
Baco,
now.
Maybe Baco, but I hate Baco Noir. I hate Baco Noir. I'd rather just wait until we have such a heat wave that it's destroying most of the crops,
yep,
and then I can plant something else. All right, we'll go opposite ends. Some suggestions for good value wine, stuff 20 and under. And if you're going to be spending over 100, say, you know, somewhere between 125, 150 for a bottle. So we'll go both ends. First, a couple suggestions. Doesn't matter the color of some value wines that you think people should check out.
I'm a big fan for whites going indigenous varieties from Italy. So like Greco di Tufo, they sit at $17. Mm-hmm. They're super tasty. They pair well. They're very easy. There's a little bit of stone fruit. There's a lot of citrus. There's high minerality and good acid. So they're always an easy buy. For reds, Portugal is taking the cake for best value.
Yeah.
I mean, you really can't go wrong with most Portuguese wines, and they're under $17. It's crazy.
And you're right, my concern, or just with Portugal, that is that people sometimes like to know what the grape is.
Yeah,
with Portugal, like beyond Tariga Nacional, and even that doesn't exactly have a lot of name recognition.
No.
I think that's the only problem is sometimes they won't put the grapes, or when they do, it's a blend of, and you've never heard of them all. I think that's the main problem it is trying to sell Portuguese wine. It's nothing against the quality. It's just, it's a hard sell.
It's more you have to get out of your head as a consumer and just accept that you might not know the grape varietal. And yeah. I mean, there's kind of a little bit of a romance on it. It's kind of like blind dating.
Yeah.
Essentially is trying Portuguese wine. It's blind dating.
No one blind
you never
dates
know
anymore. No
what
one blind dates anymore. Everyone's on, I mean, like on Tinder and stuff.
Yeah,
but
well,
yeah,
it's true.
Go back to like 25 years ago when there was blind dates.
Oh, I mean, you know, just don't Google the person before you go on a date with them. And hey, that's Portuguese wine.
Yeah. That's a perfect way of putting it.
It's It's a weird way of putting it, it's the best approach because you never are going to know. And I mean, I can't pronounce half the Portuguese grave riddles. It's not going to happen.
And by the way, you know, it's tough when you can pronounce a whole lot of German and you're having difficulty with the Portuguese. I'm going to try to remember that when I do the tweets and text and the Instagram for this. It's just you describing Portuguese wine as it's like going on a date, not Googling who the person is.
I mean, it's the easiest way.
Yeah.
Even Southern Rhone blends are kind of a great wine to go with.
Yeah.
You know, you're 20, 18, 19.
The Gugel Cote de Rhone, especially it's $3 off.
Yep. That's gone now.
Damn it. You know, it's always...
I think Perrin's on LTO right now, actually, for December. So it's $2 off.
$2 off. Okay. Because, the Gugel Cote de Rhone, you know what you're going to get. And it's always a solid one. And Gugel's always... You know, they make good wine.
They're giant.
It's a giant winery and all that. So you lose some of the romance of the tiny little mom and pop farmer shop. At the same point, they make good wine.
I mean, right now we have the Chave Moncor Cote de Rhone for $22.
Yeah.
And I mean, who doesn't love a little Chave?
Yeah. Yeah.
Classic producer.
For people out there, Chave. Yeah. Excellent Rhone. Producer.
I mean, even Cuistre de Nîmes in the Southern Rhone is doing some fantastic stuff. And you're also getting a lot more organic wines in Cuistre de Nîmes if you care about that. Gassier, they're vegan friendly.
Yeah.
So if you have that person that's going to be a pain and be vegan at your Christmas dinner, try to find,
Gassier
because they're vegan friendly.
That's a good point. And they make a good Cote de Rhone as well. I mean, bought a bunch of a couple different of their lines of wine in the past. All right. The $125 to $150. This is it's either the gift or it's the, okay, I'm not cooking any of the meal. I'm just coming over, but I'm going to bring a nice bottle because I want to share it with friends and family.
I mean, for me, it's definitely going to be Northern Rhone or Burgundy.
Yep.
Or really good Brunello. There's a few right now, and there's a lot of producers. I'm kind of liking that sweet spot of 110. So right now, I have the La Renier Brunello. Mm-hmm. And this is the producer that made them change the laws because he's so high altitude. They had to switch the rules for Brunello del Montalcino.
Yeah.
Give me some of that guy's delicious high acid Brunello any day of the week for $110.
Is that the one with it's kind of a weird dark label that looks like Impressionist art, or am I thinking of someone else?
That's someone else. So okay. Le Brenier is very white, very simple, beautiful with this little artscape.
Yep.
I mean, I would also do, if you want Spanish wines, good Rioja, like the $110, and not that it's super, super common. It's not.
No.
But I mean, those are kind of the good sweet spots for me, but I would also just buy sparkling.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Give me all of the sparkling.
Going 180 degrees, craziest customer stories.
Oof.
Because I spent a lot of time at the LCBO. I'm one of those people, even if I'm not buying anything, if I walk by an LCBO, I just like to go in. I'm curious, what's in? What's being sold? Are there any deals? And you sometimes see crazy people. You sometimes get more men than women with this. The ego guy who says, I know what, it's like, listen, I know what I'm talking about. Which you must love.
Oh, I love it. It's really hard to refrain. I'm being very politically correct right now. I'm not normally. There's so many stories. One, for starters, people, if you're showing me a photo of a wine label on your phone, please put it in a separate folder because with phones these days and taking inappropriate photos and sending it to people, I don't need to see that.
Oh, no.
And I've had so many men in Toronto show me photos that they're thinking is the wine label they want to show me, but it's not the wine label. And it's super hard not to laugh at you.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, if I'm having a bad day, I'm going to laugh in your face.
Yeah.
It's so going to happen because there's nothing else you can do.
Yeah.
I mean, the bros. I had a guy come in the other day, and one of the Canadian wine bottles has a little wine parka on it.
Yeah.
And he thought he was being funny, but he asked me if it came in men's. And I was like, really? I'm like, I looked at his girlfriend. And I was like, what are you doing?
he'll grow out of this.
He was 32 years old. He's not growing out of that.
Okay.
It's, I mean, there's tons of stories. I mean, we had a woman come in the other day and it was the first day it started snowing and she was in socks. And like one second she'd be crying, the other second she'd be dancing in the aisles. You could tell she was going to steal. So you kind of follow her around, make sure she doesn't steal the expensive stuff.
Yeah.
She ended up stealing a bottle of Sangiovese in the Tetra Paks. Mm. And because it was snowing so hard, she stayed in the vestibule drinking the stolen bottle of wine.
Oh, no.
While we're trying to wait for the cops to come. But of course, everyone forgets how to drive in the first snow. So you're waiting for a while. And
yeah.
She's just having fun, and you really can't do anything. I mean,
did she come back in for some Brunello just to up her Sangiovese value?
No, she stuck with the cheap stuff and stayed in the vestibule to stay dry. I'm guessing because that no shoe thing probably would have sucked in the winter.
Yeah, and if she had stolen Bacco Noir, you're like, we don't need to call the cops. Everyone just back to business.
I mean, at least she was smart enough to take something that you didn't need a corkscrew.
That is true.
She thought it through, despite her crazy behavior. She thought it through.
What's the craziest day of the year for you guys?
Oh, man. It's a
day before like May 2-4 weekend or Saturday, May 2-4.
I would say before May 2-4 if you're in the city. If you're in the country, it would definitely be the Saturday of May 2-4. For us, New Year's Eve all the way is crazy. Christmas Eve isn't as busy. It's the days leading up. Actually, the weeks leading up to Christmas Eve is when it gets crazy. So come next Monday, we're in for trouble.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. We start off by talking that the LCBO is an easy target.
Yes.
They are. I always complain about not being able to ship wine in to my home from all around the world.
It's
or
true.
When I do bring wine in, the amount of taxes I have to pay. I've described the LCBO as being part draconian and part paternalistic when it comes to booze. But there's two sides to that coin. Just, you know, because I like being fair and balanced. We've been critical about parts of the LCBO, but what are the best parts about the LCBO in terms of what they do in terms of people that enjoy beer, spirits, or wine?
I mean, let's put this into a whiskey term. If you go to New York, you're paying an asinine amount for Pappy Van Winkle. We charge $250, $300. That bottle is anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 in most places of the States. So you're getting it dramatically cheaper. I have people come in from the States all the time because we're selling Weller at $35 when it's $80 in the States. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying $80 US dollars, not Canadian. So, I mean, when you put it into whiskey, we do have a lot of buying control. So you're getting it at a little bit better cost. Don't get me wrong. There's some things that are priced a little higher than they should be, but for the most part, because we are such a massive company, we can dictate price, which I'm sure the wineries hate. But I mean, for consumers, it's a lot better off. I was in Italy for 3 weeks and I barely bought Brunello because it's cheaper for me to buy it here, not risk getting, you know, paying a ton of duty at the airport and get it off the shelf. So if you're looking at, you know, some of the guys, you're paying 58 euros for it at the winery when I'm paying 55 here.
Yeah, Italy, it's funny. Yes, it's cheaper to buy California wine in Buffalo than it is in Toronto. Of course, now you've got to spend money on gas and you're traveling on the QEW, which is a soul-crushing experience.
Yes.
But Italy, absolutely. Like Tomasi, for instance. You know, the LCBO's had a relationship with them for years. And those wines are far cheaper in Canada than what you're going to find at Total Wine in the United States.
It's so much cheaper. And I mean, it's a huge thing for me. I mean, I play on both sides because I still love sherry. There's an old British woman inside me somewhere saying like, sherry's going to make me live for the rest of my life.
Sherry is so good.
It's the best thing in the world, but it's so impossible because it always fails our lab.
Yeah.
Part of the LCBO is that we test every wine that comes into market to make sure, you know, if you drink enough, you won't die.
Yeah.
Sherry has high ethyl carbonate rates, so a lot of it gets denied, which is heartbreaking for me because some of my favorite producers or the older stuff will be too high in ethyl carbonate. So you can't simply bring it into the market, which is traumatizing. But for your health, I suppose it's a good thing. As I want the sherry.
You know, it's always good to have one bottle around.
I mean, there's a few and we're getting a little bit better with sherries. And
it's not a good sell.
It's not.
We're not in London, England. It's not an easy sell.
It's not an easy sell. I mean, there's markets for it. A couple years ago when I was at Queen's Quay still, I had 26 different sherries on the shelf. And I think that's the most I've ever seen. And it sold really well, mostly to restaurants, places like Bar Isabel and Cava and stuff like that.
But yeah.
You'd be surprised how many customers were coming in wanting it.
Yeah.
It was crazy, but they're easy pairing. They're high alcohol. They're super tasty. I mean, why wouldn't you want sherry? They mix well in cocktails. It's crazy.
It's one thing I discovered when I was traveling in New Zealand last year was, I don't know why I was in New Zealand, but in wineries in New Zealand, I tried just white sherry cocktails and just ridiculous good.
So super tasty.
So good. Hey, Carrie, thank you so much for doing this.
No problem.
I really appreciate it. And for people out there, if you're at the LCBO, be nice to the consultants. Be nice, you know, to the people like Carrie Mortimer out there. They do a fantastic job. They'll help you out. And to the men, you know, don't have penises on your phone. It's really like, it's not that hard. I'm 43. I can tell you, I've never had a picture of a penis on my phone ever. It's quite simple to do. So just a little non-wine tip for
you. Yeah, please don't. It's a nice shock and awe from the distraction of the day, but
yeah,
you don't really recover from that.
No, that's really not how you want to, especially like early on a Wednesday. And also, people, get your wine now. Don't wait till December 23rd. It's not milk. It ain't going to go bad. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. As always, subscribe and download it on iTunes, Stitcher, Audioboom, wherever good podcasts are sold. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.